So I wanted to begin just to, by referring to some questions that kind of came by note and that I felt would kind of benefit more than the person asking. So I'm going to start with those and then kind of go into the flow of the talk. And the first one was about anger. You know, that sometimes comes up with compassion, yeah, or in relationship to the same things that compassion comes up to, yeah, around the pain and suffering and injustice in the world. So I'm just want to touch on it. Laura touched on it a little bit, but by saying, you know, one way of working with anger is to see it as energy. Another way that I would explore anger, and particularly when it comes alongside compassion, is just to spend a little bit more time understanding what it is. Yeah. Because we tend to label a lot of things as anger, and there's actually some nuance there. Yeah. So there may be a sense of wanting to stand up against injustice, and that anger can weave in there, but there's actually something else there, which is a type of integrity, yeah, for example. Kind of get more of a kind of a bit more, spend time with it a little bit more to get a sense of what's there. And often also underlying anger there'll be pain. Yeah? So it's a layer of kind of a protective almost thing, you know, that kind of is coming to support us and to not feel that pain or to not be overwhelmed by the pain. I would say, first of all, be interested a little bit in that, or a lot. And feel that as energy, that's one way. But another is when that arises, or when pain arises, or when there's an overwhelm of any kind around areas of compassion, bring the compassion in. Yeah? Remember that flexibility, that movement, then it's our own body, heart, mind that is asking us to attend to it with compassion. And in the context of the retreat, you know, we've been kind of saying this gradual progression. So sometimes things will arise, you know, naturally, but don't go looking for the most acute suffering in the world. There's plenty of opportunities to meet that. Unless it's, you know, I don't want to make too much of a generalization there. If you're not familiar with working that kind of energy, it may not be the right time. Some of you are, so then it may be the right time to work with that as well. So that was one question. And there was another question around sometimes the challenge of bringing metta to oneself, and it can equally be with compassion or with mudita. And kind of what are ways of working with that. And so if there's access to one of the other Brahma Viharas, that's a way. Yeah. Working with, you know, if metta's not available, self-metta's not available, maybe compassion is, you know, and it can bring compassion to that sense of kind of non-flow, yeah, of the self-metta, the blockage, so we can hold that with compassion. That may be something that is useful for us. If the metta, the compassion, the mudita, whatever we're practicing, if it flows anywhere, that's the most important thing. So also not making too much of a kind of a project out of it needing to come, you know, having the self compassion or the self metta, but actually just both acknowledging that it's flowing somewhere, and when it's flowing quite well, quite steadily, opening to the fact that as you're seemingly sending metta to someone else, it's actually moving through you. Yeah. We can just kind of, almost sometimes we need to keep it half a secret from ourselves. But that's happening. Not illuminating it too strongly, but it's just actually moving through. And that's kind of, I think I mentioned 4 kind of almost doesn't matter with these Brahmaviharas, despite the emphasis on the one hand, yeah, and I'm going to contradict myself in this talk. Despite the emphasis on, you know, the expansion and them going in different directions, ultimately what matters is, you know, say the metta is flowing through, and less matters who it's going towards. Yeah? And we can tune into just that sense of actually wherever it's going, it's moving through this body, heart, mind, and we can tune into that kind of more. More focus or with less, yeah, more in the background, more in the foreground. So that's just, you know, there's other suggestions, but I think that's kind of those two, hopefully, are something to work with this. So I want to speak a little bit more broadly about kind of what we've been doing with the practice, or kind of how these practices work, and what they do. So we've been exploring, you know, in general, and particularly through the Brahmaviharas, practices that nourish well-being, and also support us to attend, and to let go of unnecessary dukkha, you know, layers of dukkha that are unnecessary. And I want to pause a little bit with dukkha, yeah, with this word, yeah, that means dissatisfaction, yeah, unease, stress, distress, a lot of translation, suffering. My favorite is ill-being, yeah, the opposite of well-being. That's Thich Nhat Hanh's translation. And I like it because it's quite broad. Yeah. Just a sense of ill-being as opposed to well-being. And another way that we can feel into dukkha is this kind of sense of being in a relationship of friction with experience. Yeah. It's like, oh, there's a friction there. Yeah. With experience, sometimes it feels with life, definitely with ourselves. And one of the kind of many strokes of genius of the Buddha, you know, is to question, you know, what does dukkha depend on? You know, what does it co-arise with? So dukkha is the dependent arising. It arises dependent on causes and conditions. And what does it arise with? It's a really important question for us to understand. And when we explore, and I do encourage us to have at some point, yeah, in our lives, our practice lives, an exploration of this question, what does it co-arise with? When there's dukkha, what else is there? And we can start to see that when there is dukkha, when there's ill-being, there'll be some degree of pushing and pulling on experience. Yeah? Or we can say of demand on experience. Yeah. I'm going to push that away because, yeah, I don't want it. I'm going to pull this towards me because I think it's going to give me happiness. Yeah. And so that movement, yeah, push, pull on experience, will be there when there's dukkha. And another thing that will be there, yeah, that demand, that push, pull, and a sense of contraction. Mm-hmm. We've been talking about this quite a bit. Yeah. Contraction in the body, contraction in the kind of more subtle energy body, contraction in awareness. And really check for yourself the next moment when there's dukkha, maybe right now. Even mild. Is there a degree of contraction? Is there something that we're pushing away or pulling towards? And we meet this in experience all the time. Laura was giving this beautiful experience this afternoon of the kind of tiredness, the sleepiness. Yeah. And equally can feel it when there's distraction in our practice. Those are things that we label as unpleasant. That's unpleasant. And that unpleasantness, that kind of seeing it as unpleasant, will then bring an escalation of, I need to get rid of, or I need to hold on to. A demand for things to be different or to stay the same all the time. Kind of, I don't want this, I want that. And of course the subtext there also is all of this. I've touched on it, but we can't hear it too many times, is, things to be a certain way for me. A demand to get this or to get rid of that, so that things are okay for me. So there is that kind of alongside with the contraction, with the push pull, with the demand, there will also be a sense of for me. And so dukkha, contraction, demand, push-pull on experience co-arise. They depend on each other. They come together. And this is really interesting for us, because we can say, when there's dukkha, there's contraction. What happens when the contraction goes down? And that's what we've been exploring. The dukkha goes down. Because they're codependent. So when there's less contraction or less demand or less push-pull on experience, there's also less dukkha. And this is something that is so important to see and to understand and to see again and again and again. It's a gateway to well-being and freedom. So how does this relate to these four immeasurable qualities? They are antidotes to dukkha. They're antidotes to dukkha. They bring the opposite of dukkha, they bring well-being. But it's interesting again to reflect on how, what actually happens there. And I will suggest and encourage you to explore in your own experience, when there is metta or compassion or mudita, what happens to the degree of demand? What happens to the degree of contraction? And what happens to that push-pull and experience? And we may see that they reduce all of that. All of that goes down. Less demand, less contraction, less push-pull and experience. And then that possibility to move from the reactivity to responsiveness. And we can, hopefully, we've had moments when we've seen that in our own practice. I think some of us here have had some interesting encounters with boredom. Anyone been bored today? In the last 3 days? Come on, be honest. You're bored right now. It's possible to meet boredom in a different way. And you can say, what happens when we meet boredom with appreciation or interest? Ever tried that? It's pretty cool. So we're applying the Brahma Viharas as an antidote, because what typically happens, boredom is there, and we feel aversion. And it's really interesting how much aversion and unpleasantness can build up around the experience of not much going on. And it gets even more interesting because many of us, if asked why we meditate, would say, because we want calm and tranquility, peacefulness, not much going on. Really interesting. So what happens, when boredom arises, when boredom arises, and we actually appreciate the not much going on. Ah, this is calm. Because boredom is calmness. Yeah? It's calmness without interest. Yeah? Or calmness with aversion. And one thing that the Brahma Viharas teach us is that we can start to sprinkle ingredients in. So, you know, if there's boredom, we can say, ah, let's appreciate the calmness and see what happens. It's not very likely that we'll get more bored because there's appreciation, or can bring interest in to see it. And we can see then that what changes is the degree of aversion, and of contraction in the experience. Yeah. So this is an example how we can bring in Brahma Viharas in ways that reduce dukkha. And so that allows us, you know, when we kind of become more familiar with these, and kind of more adventurous with applying them, more possibilities to respond to experience in alignment with our aspirations and our priorities. And just generally more possibilities of response. Yeah. We have more possibilities of response, more freedom of movement. Every time I move, I get a hiss. Yeah. So an example of that, you know, I mentioned, you know, this morning, a sense of maybe we have, you know, a sense of appreciation for the privilege of being here. Maybe we have a sense of guilt for the privilege of being here. Yeah. That may be coming up for some of us some of the time. We can attend to that. What happens when we bring compassion? There's a sense of guilt for the privilege that we may be feeling. What happens when we bring compassion for that? Yeah. And we say, ah, yeah, this is painful. But I can bring compassion to myself, and I can also bring a big picture compassion that sees that taking this time to care for me can be in service of wider needs. Yeah. Because of that interconnection, as we're more resourced, we also have more to offer. So again, does this make sense? Yeah, we bring in the Brahma Viharas and they shape the experience, or they kind of sprinkle in this movement from the contractedness, the demand, the ill-being, towards well-being and towards possibilities of response. So all the practices we've done so far, all the Brahma Viharas, they reduce dukkha in these ways, easing the contraction, easing the push-pull experience and the demand. And we can say, you know, that they go against the stream of our conditioned reactivity. Each of them has a slightly different flavour of doing that. And, you know, between us, there may be a particular flavour that really works for us, and we can take that and work with it. And over time, as we become more familiar with all of them, we have, you know, like a whole array of spices to season, to sprinkle into our lives. I want to go a little bit more here, speaking about these particular flavours, into mudita in its kind of aspect of the unselfish or altruistic joy. So this morning spoke a lot about the appreciative joy aspect, and then there's also the unselfish. They're not really separate, but I just want to go into that a little bit more. When we reflect on experiences that we have had, whether it's today or in our lives, where there's been a deep sense of joy, of gladness, of contentment, of appreciation, of gratitude, this whole family that mudita encompasses, perhaps we can see that those deep places of joy are open, they're expansive, they connect us to others, rather than being self-referential and self-centered. Yeah, it's really interesting to see that. That makes sense to people? Yeah, you think of when you're really, really happy. And this connects us to some really big questions about what brings happiness. Yeah. When we feel really kind of, there's a gladness, there's a gratitude in the heart. It's actually not very self-centered at all. And so again, it arises with less contraction and less demand. Yeah. It arises with less for me. Yeah. Remember the for me? Yeah. A demand for things to be a certain way for me, which is also a factor that builds dukkha. Yeah. It co-arises with the contraction, the demand and the push-pull. And the stronger it is, the more dukkha there will be. The stronger the dukkha is, the louder the me voice will be. Yeah. And us. And again, don't just believe me. Yeah. Check in your own experience. And we can see the opposite also. Yeah. Maybe, you know, we've had moments, a moment of joy, and then that holding on to it comes a contraction. What happens to it? Yes, like crushing a flower. Yeah? You try to hold on to it and it fades. Yeah, yeah. That William Blake quote. Yeah. I get tired. You can really tell English is not my first language. So, yeah. That William Blake quote, you know, kiss the joy as it flies, yeah? So relevant. Yeah? Because if we try to catch it, and if we try to hold on to it, yeah, actually disappears. So it kind of comes with that open hand, it comes with that expansiveness. Yeah? And that's part of why it's a powerful, a liberating, freeing, yeah, way of being, way of relating. So when we hold on to it, when we try to make it last, and when we try to keep it for ourselves, which is a very strong conditioning that we have. So again, it's not personal, yeah, but it's helpful to see. So kind of co-star in this show alongside Laura and me and the Buddha is the Dalai Lama. Appeared a lot in this retreat. He's got some beautiful, many, many beautiful and profound things to say. And one of them is he talks about mudita as enlightened self-interest, yeah, in its unselfish, yeah, joy element. And he says, you know, that the so many other beings in this world that it's simply reasonable to allow their happiness to matter to us. Yeah? So to extend the field, yeah, of happiness and well-being to others. Because if we can be happy when good things happen to others, not just to ourselves or to those that are close to us, our opportunities for delight increase, yeah, infinitely. Yeah, infinitely. He's a wise guy with a good laugh. Yeah. And I often kind of share this story and reflect on it myself from years ago. I used to participate and then co-teach on these yatras, on these walks in France. Oh, another walk. On these walks in France where, you know, up to 200 people would be walking in silence through the French countryside and camping in fields that French farmers let you just camp in. That's quite mind-boggling in Britain. You know, they just let you camp in their fields, even a large group of people. Anyway, it was July or August, it was hot in the south of France, it was a really, really hot day, and we were walking in the middle of the day, and it was hot, hot, and there I am in the line of people feeling the heat. And we started walking into a town. Yeah? And so, you know, the heat rises with the pavements and the roads. But as we're walking and I'm feeling the heat and I'm staying just mindful with the heat, hot, contraction, relax, hot, contraction, relax. And then as we walk by a house, we can't see because there's a fence, but suddenly I can hear the sounds of people splashing in a swimming pool. And the immediate response is delight. Yeah? Mudita arises. Yeah? And it's as refreshing, yeah, as being in the swimming pool myself. Yeah? I just keep walking. Yeah? But that's, sometimes it happens to us. Yeah? And we tend to miss those times because we're not present enough. Or like Laura said today, I love that. You know, she said, you know, we miss out on so much because we think we know. Yeah. Oh, it's hot. Yeah. They've got a swimming pool and I haven't. Yeah. And so, you know, and that was such a, just that immediate resonance of hearing without the self-centeredness, yeah, joy. Yeah. Joy. Expansion. Yeah. And just that sense of the why. It doesn't matter who's in the swimming pool, me or somebody else. Yeah. Right now, there's a cooling down happening somewhere. Yeah. And I can take part of it because our perceptions are that, you know, powerful. Yeah. That powerful. So that movement, yeah, the experience shifting from unpleasantness, yeah, being worked with, being, you know, there's presence, there's working with the contraction, but shifting from something unpleasant to really deep well-being, yeah, without the actual conditions changing for this particular body. I'm still walking on a hot street, yeah, in a town in the middle of the day, yeah, in a heat wave. Still going on. So we can start to see the wisdom, yeah, of that is revealed, yeah, with these practices, the experiential wisdom. Realizing that well-being and happiness are not finite, they're not limited in the ways we sometimes see them, habitually see them. We don't need to grasp on, we don't need to hold on, we don't need to push and pull all the time. Yeah. There is goodness there available. And the joy of others does not limit our own chances of happiness, yeah, which is a very, very strong tendency we have. Yeah, that sense of there's not enough. And if someone has it, then there's less chance I will. Actually, it's the opposite. As the Dalai Lama reminds us. If we train the heart and mind to be concerned with a wider base, the wider circle of care, then more happiness and well-being becomes possible. And part of what mudita practice does is this shifting of the emphasis from who is feeling joy, yeah, who is plunging in the pool right now, yeah, for whom things are going well, to the joy itself. Yeah, to the joy itself. It shifts what we're looking at. Yeah. Who is this happening to? Shifts to this is happening. Yeah. There is joy, there is coolness. It goes back to what I said about liking to watch people doing their walking practice. Yeah. This is, ah, oh, someone there, no, really immersed, or it looks like it at least. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes people have come to me and said, oh, wow, you look so into it when you were practicing. I think I was so not into it when I was practicing, like full on hindrance attacks. But I don't say it because I just think, great, you know, enjoy. have that sense of joy. But we can have a sense, but we don't know what's going on, but we can enjoy that dedication of someone else's experience. So that shift of the emphasis from who is feeling the joy, where it is, to the fact that it is. The fact that there is joy, that there's contentment, that there's metta, there's gladness, that something is going well. And sometimes this feels like a healthy stretch, and that's great, It's just like we know that a stretch can feel healthy and we know where it can become a strain. And we're kind of mindful and attentive to that. And so we're mindful of that when we remember that deep well-being can be cultivated, can be developed. This is what this path is about. Deep well-being that is not dependent on conditions, not dependent on things going my way. And it's one of my favorite teachings from the Buddha. Whatever the practitioner frequently thinks and ponders upon, that becomes the inclination of the mind. So profound, so true, so beautiful. Whatever the practitioner frequently ponders and thinks upon, that will become the inclination of the mind. We can train, we can develop, we can cultivate. And when we incline the mind towards wholesome states, when we act from this wholesome state, from them we begin to shift and change our habits. And of course, again, research now shows us that this is true on a from a scientific perspective as well. We can, through repetition, strengthen positive neural pathways in the brain. And so an increase of well-being in the immediate over time. And cultivation of the capacity to turn attention intentionally towards particular aspects of experience and particular ways of relating. I give this example recently of seeing the fruits of the practice. I started having hot flushes. I can't even remember when, maybe about 18 months ago, 2 years ago, I can't remember. And the interesting thing was, you know hot flushes? Yeah, lots of you do. And when they started, my response when was like, wow, look what my body's doing. And I still, it's still like, look what my body's doing. It's incredible. It can actually generate this incredible heat out of nowhere. And then it goes. And I actually get cold flushes, which I think, not a lot of people get. It's really cold now. So I'm saying that because it's like just seeing the fruit of the practice. Something which, most people who experience it will agree is not on the pleasant range of experiences, to say the least. But then, the inclination of the mind, to appreciation, to curiosity, to wonder, and to see, what is there to appreciate here? And it just becomes that inclination. Not always, got to say. Sometimes, sorry, I'm just giving you a bit of entertainment because you look sleepy and I still have quite a lot to say. Lie in bed and look at my partner sleeping away and think, why me and not him? And that's, going on. So not always, but enough. Enough of the time to feel, this stuff works. This stuff works. And it makes a huge difference. A huge difference. And so this stuff works. And I just want to talk a little bit more about that. We've mentioned how the trajectory of the immeasurable is this expansion towards including more and more beings. More and more beings and more of the range of our experience. And that kind of hot flash story is good for that. Includes more of our experience. So it's not just about other beings, it's also about the relationship to our own experience in the body, in the heart and the mind. And over time, our practice, and some of you may be at that ripeness or maturity, and for others it's not the time yet. Over time we want to include the more challenging, more challenging relationships, more challenging situations, the more challenging aspects of our own experience. And that is in the service of something, and I want to kind of talk a little bit more about that. Thinking one, maybe the first ever immeasurable retreat I taught, or one of the first. Someone came to me when I was teaching, after teaching the mudita, came to a one-to-one mudita day, and he was quite upset, quite upset with me, and with the practice, with the teaching. He said to me, "Are you telling me that I need to feel happy for those bankers that just got big fat bonus? Are you telling me that I need to feel happy for them?" And it's a really good question. It's a really, really good question. What is this? What is this teaching saying? Where is it pointing to? And so the answer to that question, I'm sure you're really curious to know, is on the one hand, yes. We are cultivating the capacity to be happy for the good things that happen to anyone. And on the other hand, we really want to question, does getting a big fat bonus make you happy? So that's kind of another, just kind of, where does happiness come from? But ultimately, it is about expanding and kind of remembering that as we're moving at our own pace. Very, very important. And I want to, again, give an example from my own experience about that pacing. About that pacing. So very kind of very difficult relationship in my life. Very difficult. And for many years, all I could do in relationship to that relationship was to practice self-metta and self-compassion. And I'm saying all I can do, that's doing a lot. And it's really wonderful to be able to do that. And for years, it was just that, self-metta, self-compassion, in the face of the distress that would come up in the face of that relationship. And then after quite a few years, it evolved to being able to send metta to this other person without having direct contact with them. So I could, without having contact, I could actually bring metta to the person in my formal practice. A few more years of that. Eventually, it became possible to be in contact and to even kind of provide some support. And of course, always particular conditions that we're talking about. So this isn't the trajectory that any challenging relationship will take. But I want to kind of give that example to say sometimes it can take a really, really long time. We move at that pace that it takes. There has to be an organic, kind of a well-supported process. Well-supported process. And there's no rush. There's no rush. And so, we've been saying, on this retreat we're not not encouraging you, if this is an early meeting for you with these Brahma Viharas, or whatever you are, we're not encouraging you to go to the challenging relationships. But I do also want to say this is where it's going, yeah? To be transparent with you. The bankers are coming. If that's your particular thing. Yeah, and it's really, really helpful to remember. Going at the pace that is right for each of us with each particular relationship, and working with the milder challenges, even when we start engaging with the challenging, if we do. It is interesting that once we can expand into the challenging range over time, you know, that just opens up one challenging relationship. That kind of, we work through and we gain the confidence and the capacity to work with more. But that wisdom again, so wisdom is a real important aspect of the immeasurables, which kind of discerns the when and the how, and also guides the Brahma Viharas in the appropriate directionality and flavour. So do I bring in the self-metta, the self-compassion for how long? Do I work when I work with someone else and I feel the heart closing? What's the appropriate thing then? For some challenging relationships, I find mudita works really well, because if I can have a sense of that person being happy, I know that they're not going to act harmfully. Yeah? So that kind of comes in as well. So the appropriate directionality and appropriate flavour of the particular Brahma Vihara. How are you doing? You got energy for a bit more? I should ask it the other way around. Has anyone had enough? And feel free, if you are, to just kind of let go and not try to catch what I'm saying, but just practice with a body or with a sound, just a sound. It's all being recorded. You can listen to it later. So reason why I wanted to spend time with this sense of the expansion of the Brahma Viharas, the fact that they expand and they include more and more and more. And we do that, as we said, to different types of relationships, but also as we've been doing here, opening to kind of people around us here, opening to the whole world. There's that sense of expansion. This expansion opens up and nourishes the fourth Brahma Vihara, equanimity. And I just want to say a little bit more about that, upeka, in Pali, and equanimity. Because as our capacity to bring any of the other three Brahma Viharas to more and more areas, to more and more beings, and like I said, the beings don't need to be the challenging beings, they can just be all beings. All beings. That expansion nourishes upeka. Upeka as equanimity, as being equally close to all things. That's one of the meanings, and my favourite one. That sense of, that circle of care becomes very wide, very expansive. And it's so expansive that it's also very restful. Some of you have been speaking about that. Any of the Brahma Viharas are very expansive. It's a very restful place as well. So this is one way that working with the Brahma Viharas nourishes and supports equanimity to come forth. Another way is particular to mudita and compassion and the way they work together. So I don't know if you've noticed that, but mudita and compassion, they both have a kind of tenderness to them. We're touched, we're moved. And that's, we're touched by the beauty of the world, and we're touched by the sorrow of the world. Right? And it's the same heart. It's the same mechanism. And sometimes it can feel, actually, when we really look at it, very, very close. And so mudita and compassion, they work together to both strengthen our heart and expand it.
Yeah.
Open it. Yeah. Open the range of what we can be sensitive to, what we can be open to. So mudita opens it, yeah, to see more and more subtle beauty, more and more things that go hidden that we don't usually notice. Yeah. It opens it that way. And compassion opens the range of what we can be with on the sorrow and pain side. But they're both opening the heart together. So one heart that feels both compassion and joy, and as we practice them, the range increases. Yeah, and the sensitivity and the tenderness grows. Yeah. And the container grows. And with the larger container, another factor of equanimity, more spaciousness, more expansiveness. Yeah. Just a sense of more, yeah, that we can hold, that we can open to, that we can be with. Yeah. Does that make sense? Yeah. Kind of example from my own practice and relevant to a few of you here who've been there. It's the leprosy community where I used to go every year for 15 years in India. And used to have this walk, used to do a work retreat there for 3 weeks. And with a 1 week meditation retreat, silent meditation retreat before that. And I used to work in the, what they call the wisdom bank, where those people who are mostly elderly could no longer work, they were living in this one communal place, and I used to go and massage and brush hair and cut nails and do all these acts of care. Great honour. But what I wanted to speak about here, about this kind of opening of the compassion and the joy, was that the walk, you know, it used to be like a 10-minute walk from the guest house where we stayed in the community to the wisdom bank. And when I would walk back after spending a few hours there, I used to call it in my mind the road of the broken hearts. Yeah. Because my heart would just, I would meet people constantly, you know, walking up and down, going here and there. And every meeting, you know, be really tender. And my heart would just keep breaking again and again. Both with the most profound joy. Yeah. In community, it's called Anandaman, the forest of joy. Yeah. Profound joy in the connection and the beauty of the people. And also the profound, you know, sorrow of many of their experiences. Yeah. But the sense of the two together, the same heart feeling both, the same, often in the same, kind of almost in the same interaction. So as the heart white grows wider, yeah, and more tender and more sensitive, the equanimity also grows. And the equanimity comes in also as that balance, yeah, that inner balance that keeps us steady in the midst of these movements of joys and sorrows that are the human condition. Yeah, pain and the beauty, part of living this life. So the last thing I want to say about this relationship between equanimity and the other Brahmaviharas is that we can see in the Tibetan tradition, equanimity is taught as the ground of the Brahmaviharas. So we've been talking about metta, yeah? As you know, when metta meets pain becomes compassion, when it meets what's going well becomes mudita. And in the Tibetan tradition, they speak about equanimity as the ground. Yeah, it's a really beautiful way to see both. Because yeah? Equanimity kind of supports that sense of friendliness, yeah? To be steady and ongoing. It supports the compassion, yeah? To not overwhelm us. It supports the mudita, to not also overwhelm us, to not become too giddy, too energetic. But we can also see equanimity as a refinement of the other three Paramaviharas. I just want to say something about that. When metta gets very, very refined, so all these qualities, they move along a spectrum of refinement. When metta becomes very, very refined, it becomes non-ill will. Becomes non-ill will. The absence of ill will. Absence of enmity. The absence of animosity. And that is actually equanimity. When compassion gets very, very refined, it becomes non-cruelty. Absence of cruelty. And that also is a form of equanimity. And when mudita, when joy gets refined and deepens, it becomes peacefulness, very profound peacefulness. And that too is a form of equanimity. So, feels like I've offered you a bedtime story. But yeah, let's just have a quiet moment to bring this to a close. So as we let the resonance of the talk settle, the heart and mind, having that sense of honouring, respecting our own heart and mind, appreciating it, where it is, how it is, right now. And at the same time, also holding that appreciation for the potential and the possibility that is within each of us, in all of us. Cultivate the mind without ill will, without cruelty. Abundant, exalted, and immeasurable. Presence in your listening, in your practice.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.